Making a recipe that calls for butter? Make it better with European butter from France. With a minimum of 82% butterfat, it's no wonder French butter is the number one choice for chefs the world over. Whether you're whipping up an omelet, sauteing vegetables, or spreading it on toast, the rich, cultured flavor of butter from France always elevates. Be sure to look for Made in France on the label, and for recipes, tips, and tricks, go to tasteeurope.com.
I'm also a huge proponent of using a scale. You have to measure accurately if you want to make consistent pizza at home. You have to use a scale. If you don't, when you're trying to troubleshoot, like why your dough maybe was a little too wet, you need to be able to make like meaningful adjustments, and the only way to do it is if you've measured accurately.
This is Taste. I'm your host, Matt Rodbard. Pizza is at the center of this lively episode. First up is Allie Stafford, one of our favorite recipe writers on the internet. Allie is behind Alexandra's Kitchen and the author of a great new cookbook, Pizza Night. We talk about Allie's favorite styles of pizza and what inspired her to write an entire book dedicated to home pizza adventures. You need to pick this one up. I mean, pizza at home, how could you go wrong? Also on the show, we have a great conversation with Emily Hyland, the founder of Pizza Loves Emily and Emmy Squared, two wildly successful pizza outfits that bring Detroit-style pie and burgers to the masses. It's great catching up with Allie and Emily and hearing their cool pizza journeys. I hope you enjoyed these conversations. Allie Stafford, welcome to This Is Taste. Hello.
Hi, thank you for having me.
It's wonderful to meet you. Thank you for coming in.
It's so nice to meet you too. I've been a huge fan of your podcast for years, and so this is wonderful.
I've been a huge fan of your writing and your newsletter and what you stand for, which is like home cooking.
Thank you.
There's no one better. And I love the energy, and I love that you have a following that's dedicated. That's really cool.
Thank you. Thank you.
So we have to pizza night. Like we're gonna just like go from the jump. All right. Three favorite regional pizza styles. You must have some. You've done this deep research. The book is amazing, tremendous. I really love any recipes for home pizza, but you've really cracked a lot of codes. Three regional favorites.
I have to start with New Haven style pizza. I grew up 20 minutes from New Haven, and it is still near and dear to my heart. It's still my favorite style of pizza. I think it's true what people say. The style that you are kind of introduced to when you're young often is your favorite. When people think of New Haven style pizza, they think of Sally's, Pepe's, Modern. My favorite is a place called Bar, which is less known when people think of New Haven style pizza, but it's still the same style. It's delicious. It's a little bit thinner. It still has a really nice chew to it. I always recommend people order the smaller bar pizzas instead of the giant ones. I think they bake a little bit better, a little bit crisper. Their white clam pizza with lemon, I don't think it gets any better than that.
Okay, we got New Haven. There's got to be a couple other more.
Yes. Can I go abroad for
you
one of the styles?
Absolutely can. Pizza may have come from abroad or maybe hasn't. We'll get into that a little bit.
So I went to Italy a couple summers ago. My husband and I went, and Pizza Night was in mind. This was research for the book. And I left, here thinking I'm going to fall in love with Neapolitan style pizza. We went to Rome and Naples. It was a really quick trip, 5 days, ate a lot of pizza. I loved the Neapolitan style pizza, but it was the tonda style, the like really, really thin crust pizzas that were served at Roman pizzerias. The two that come to mind are Da Remo and Ostiense. I'd left dreaming about those pizzas. They were so good. They're thin. It's not like cracker thin. It's thin but pliable. The sauce, the top, everything is spread all the way to the edge. And it's so good.
All right. So we've got New Haven. We've got like Italian, but Rome.
Sure.
What do you got?
I guess after that, I would say I've become a huge fan of just the pan pizza genre. I have not had like real buddies Detroit style pizza, so I can't speak to that, but I love a Detroit style pizza. I love a Sicilian style pizza. I feel like for entertaining, that is the way to go. I love making, the Neapolitan styles and thin crust pizzas one by one, but in terms of, entertaining and having people over, it's not ideal to be assembling and, you know, making pizza, assembling, you know, baking pizza, a big pan pizza that feeds a lot of people is such a gift. And once you learn how to make it, it's kind of hard to not make those styles for that.
It's a gift.
It is.
You said it, and you can also give somebody a pan in your book, and like we'll call that a gift
as
well.
Yes, exactly.
I think like it's once you do pan, it's like no going back because it is a little bit foolproof.
Yes.
You're going to burn less.
Absolutely.
It also brings a lot of flavor into the crust.
Absolutely. I think it is way more foolproof. I think it's easier for the, with the, like just a regular, I mean, I love the Lloyd blue steel pans for Detroit style, but a regular sheet pan for a Sicilian style with a par bake, it's going to be, you know, you're going to make an excellent pizza. You know, the crust will be perfect regardless if you have a fancy pan.
Before we get to your pizza journey, because I really am curious about why pizza, after your absolutely amazing book, Bread, Toast, Crumbs, you released it right when I joined this company, and I just remember looking at it in this like small little book. I was like, oh my God, this book is amazing. It sold a lot of copies. We have a lot of fans. But before we get into the segue from Bread, Toast, Crumbs to pizza, I want to get into your background.
Sure.
You worked at Fork in Philadelphia, which is an amazing restaurant, really, really influential. And I don't know if a lot of your followers know of your professional background. So let's talk about that.
Sure. I mean, it was wonderful. I had, prior to being at Fork, I had worked, well, I went to culinary school only because I thought that I had to. I did a quick 6-month program. It turns out you didn't need to go to culinary school to get a job at a restaurant, at least back then. And then I worked at a catering company for a while, and I loved it. But when I got to Fork, the chef, Tien Nguyen, who was Vietnamese, he really like took me under his wing. He always reminded me, part of the reason why he hired me was that I actually didn't have a lot of restaurant experience, which he loved because then I didn't have a lot of bad habits. He saw that I was eager to learn. I loved eating everything. He would make these like egg sandwiches with Chinese sausage for breakfast.
Killer staff meal.
It was great. So good. He always had a stash of like rice noodles under his table, like wrapped in cellophane. They were very like oily, but he would pull them out, chop them up. Like fill them with like, it would be like sauteed shiitake mushrooms and shrimp. And then he'd steam them and make a little sauce. And it was just, I mean, I look back and it was so magical. And that was just like addition to what we were making at Fork. And then we would ride our bikes all over Chinatown and eat at, I mean, really any place that he wanted to. And I feel like that's where I really got an education about food. We would go on these adventures. And the owner, Ellen Yin, who I am still in very close touch with today, she would be on these adventures. Her partner, Wayne, would be on these adventures. We worked, but then late at night we would hang out, and it was fun. It was magical.
I love that you mentioned Ellen. She's been on our show and just an inspiration. She's a cool lady and who has a great sense of style with operating and just like treating staff right. It's obvious when speaking to any of her staff. And what's the menu like at Fork when you're cooking there?
Well, it's changed so much since I was
there. That's what's cool about it.
Yes, it is. And honestly, I haven't eaten there recently, so I can't speak to the current menu. But I know it's delicious.
Yeah. But you were doing eclectic cuisine when you were cooking there?
When I was there, yes. It was like, I think, considered like new American bistro. I mean, the things I remember were there was always a hanger steak on the menu with yuca frites. What else did we have? There was always like a romaine salad with sauce grabiche, which was this like delicious dressing.
I love sauce grabiche. Yeah. So good.
It was like Tien had worked in France for 17 years. He was Vietnamese, but like there were lots of various influences from like many cultures. It was good. There was always like a beet salad on the menu.
Yeah. Like you're this like wheelhouse new American.
Yes, exactly.
And God, we love a new American. I mean, new American. Yeah. Come on. It's like a hug. Like,
right.
I love a hanger steak. I love a Caesar salad.
Totally. Beets. Yes. Yeah. Can't go wrong.
When you launch your website, mm-hmm. I mean, you may previously known as a blog.
Yeah.
We'll call it a website and then newsletter. You know, what was the goal when you started doing like writing your own recipes and just blogging or writing about your culinary adventures?
I mean, there was no goal back then. This was 2006. I think 2007. I had just stopped working at Fork. I had been writing for a small newspaper that didn't have a lot of space for a food section. And I thought, people are starting blogs. I'll just, you know, start a blog to fill up what I can't fit in the newspaper, write about the things I'm discovering, whether it's a farmer's market or I had just joined my first CSA. So I was like chronicling my like CSA vegetables, writing about things I had learned at Fork that, you know, again, that were maybe not right for the newspaper. It really wasn't, it was just for fun. I wrote it. I didn't think about trying to get anybody to read it. There was no, I feel like the first social media after that was like, everybody was like, start a Facebook page for your blog.
Yeah.
I didn't do that for years. Years passed before I did that. I just didn't care. And then it was really like, I would probably maybe 6 or 7 years in, I started having kids. I had been working at a graphic design firm. That was another story. And I couldn't, I wasn't like making enough money to like warrant paying for childcare. At least I didn't, couldn't rationalize.
Yeah.
And so I saw that people were making money on their blogs, but just by putting ads on. And I was like, okay, I'll give this a try. And it was, of course, started very small, you know, but it was enough to be like, oh, okay, if I make this better, if I make the recipes better, if I make the experience better.
It's better is what drove you. Was it more? I mean, I loved it, this early food internet story. I mean, I've had this story with Deb Perlman.
Yes,
I had this story with Jenny Rosenstretch. Like, we hear about, and we hear with Natasha's Kitchen, who's a newer story.
Yep.
But, like, there's always that moment when you realize it's working. Was there a moment for you?
There were a few. So I had two recipes. And again, I'm not somebody who looks at analytics. Also, I'm terrible with Google Analytics. I can't. My brain doesn't work that way. I knew that two of my posts always did well. It was this buttermilk blueberry breakfast cake that just would, every spring and summer, it just would go bananas. And that was the only thing I could tell by Google Analytics because I could see a spike. And then my mother's peasant bread recipe, which is what inspired the whole bread toast crumbs cookbook.
It's like the nexus of that idea, that book.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. That same thing. That recipe took off. And when I saw that I had two, but it was really like, it was two posts that were driving the bulk of my traffic. It was then that I kind of was like, okay, I get it. It's like, if you can get enough posts that people will visit, you know, time and time again, then you can, you know, maybe earn some more money.
Mm-hmm.
And it really was when, I mean, it was maybe 3 or 4 years ago, I started working with an SEO company that does SEO and tech support, but they're very not like, they do not have you write for SEO. Like, I would never write a post for, but they just helped me. They were like, you have these posts, these older posts that are doing well, like make them better. And that was sort of like, it was really just about making my existing library better. And that helped.
That's great. I mean, it sounds like you did the thing that is hard, which is like not care, right? Like no one's reading, but also do it in a way that's actually good. And your audience loves that you're authentic.
Yes. No, I do. I think that it's, I mean, the food blogosphere has changed so much and there are lots of sites that are writing just for, I mean, you come across them and you know, they're answering all these frequently asked questions. You don't even know who's behind it. And I don't think that really appeals. I mean, I guess if you just want the recipe, sure. But I think people do like connecting with somebody. They, you know, they want to know who's behind the recipe. They want to know the story.
Yeah. So today you're on Substack, you do some Substack work. You do recipe work. Is it like a business now that you run?
It is, yes. Yeah. I mean, cool. I am not making money from Substack, and it's because I make money from my blog. I feel like I do have ads on my blog. They're annoying. I'm constantly trying to cut them back, and I like sort of am always like telling my readers, it's like, well, you get this free content for and you have to deal with the annoying ads. So I just enjoy it for what it is at the moment. Maybe at some point I'd monetize it, but
Do your thing.
Yeah.
So let's talk about pizza because, you know, your Substack about Friday Night Pizza.
Mm-hmm.
Did that lead to the book?
No. So I actually started that after.
After the book.
It was really it was last December.
Yeah.
I think you know, like the book was like totally in. There were no more edits to be made.
I see.
And
you, instead of taking like an exhale and being like, I'm chill, you're like, let's do a Substack.
I did this. So I had a previous Substack, which was called the Farm Share Newsletter. And I did that for 2 years. And it was all about chronicling the CSA and helping people with those recipes. And I did that because when I found that if I like wove it into the blog, it was too hard to find all the CSA posts. Like it was really, the Substack makes it kind of a standalone website. And I felt like by starting a pizza Substack, I could really just focus on the people like who, and I have this other main newsletter that I write. And every week on that newsletter, I tell people what I've done in the pizza newsletter. And so some more people come over, but I don't want to. A lot of people who read my blog are not necessarily pizza people.
Yeah.
And so it's almost like a way of, what's the word, like segmenting your list.
Yeah.
It's just by like finding the people who really care about pizza so that I can really just, when I want to do pizza stuff, I can just direct it to people who really are into it.
Allie, let's talk about, who are these pizza people? I mean, these are my people, obviously, but when you say pizza people, who are these readers? What are they like?
Well, I feel like pizza is having more and more people. More and more people are getting into pizza. I mean, I always loved making pizza. I remember making pizza with my mom. I think it was the Figs Table Cookbook. It was Todd English. Like, his recipe we used for years, and we loved it. We would just make it on a sheet pan. We thought it was excellent. Like, looking back, we'd probably think it was terrible now if we...
No.
But I don't know. But anyway, my mom's always loved making bread. So working with dough has always been second nature to me. I'm not afraid of bread or yeast. Many people are, but I feel like maybe, like, probably post-pandemic, when everybody started making bread and sourdough and people are just getting more comfortable, I think, with bread and yeast and getting more comfortable making pizza. I think the rise of like Uni and Gosney and these other backdoor ovens that aren't as expensive as they once were also are encouraging people to get into.
But we need the recipes. We need these one-page recipes that are written simply. The design of your book is really nice. I like the way it's laid out. I like it's very easy to follow. And we'll get into some of the recipes, but it seems like this book is made for now.
Yeah. I mean, I think one of the biggest sort of revelations for me when I was like working on the pizza recipes was understanding the relationship between the amount of water in a dough and like the temperature that you're cooking. So we're getting really right into the nitty gritty with
this. Let's do it. We're going in.
Okay. So like, for example, like Neapolitan style pizza, I think people go out to eat at a Neapolitan style restaurant. They're like, oh, I want to make that at home. And they find a recipe for Neapolitan style pizza dough, a classic recipe. And it turns out terribly in their oven. And it's because they're using classic Neapolitan style pizza dough is relatively low hydration, 60% hydration or less or a little bit more, and I feel like your listeners are very knowledgeable, but that just means low amount of water relative to flour. And that works in a 900-degree oven when there's only 60 seconds for that water to dry out. So it's going to be light and fluffy and airy. But if you do that in your home oven and the pizza takes 6 to 10 minutes, it's going to be a brick when it comes out.
Yeah, and it becomes like a big, like, the crusts are, like, oversized, hard.
Exactly. So if you want to make Neapolitan-style pizza in your home oven, you have to start with more water from the start. So I like a really high hydration dough. It's 77%. It's not like unmanageable. Also, people, they see that you have to use 00 flour, and 00 flour is great. Again, it's great in a outdoor oven. It doesn't brown well. Something like King Arthur flour, bread flour, or all purpose flour that has malt in it that helps with browning, that is going to be a home baker's best friend. Browning in a home oven can be really, really challenging. Investing in a baking steel. I'm a huge proponent of the baking steel. I think it's game changing.
You have a brand that you like?
I love the original baking steel.
Yeah.
From the very beginning. I think it's fantastic. I have recently invested in the Pro, which is very, very heavy. I don't recommend it for people who have to move it in and out of their
who
oven.
Value their fingers and the dexterity of their
exactly.
Drop it on your feet. Yeah,
exactly. But it is fantastic. I mean, if you have a pizza stone and you're happy with it, don't swap it out. But when you're ready to make the leap, I know just people who have had a stone forever, and when they switch to the steel, they're like, why did I wait so long?
I inherited a stone from the previous owner of my oven, and I had to throw it out. It just was too unwieldy.
Yes.
To
yeah.
Yeah.
So it's really about understanding, I feel like, those relationships. I mean, I'm also a huge proponent of using a scale. You have to measure accurately if you want to make consistent pizza at home. And you have to use a scale. If you don't, when you're trying to troubleshoot, like, why your dough maybe was a little too wet, you need to be able to make, like, meaningful adjustments. And the only way to do it is if you've measured accurately.
They cost $12.
Exactly.
Scali makes a nice one. They look kind of cool.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. This is really cool, and you really articulate well that this is for the home cook. Like, and there's a lot of mistakes. You've probably made them, I would imagine.
Oh, definitely. Yes. Yeah. And I have troubleshooted with people over the years. It really is about so many people's problem is just that their home oven doesn't get hot enough, or they're not taking the time to really preheat their steel for long enough. And I get it. You get home and you don't have time. Your dough is cold and you're trying to force it and stretch it, and your oven hasn't preheated properly, and you throw your pizza in the oven because people are hungry. It's not gonna come out great.
It's kind of just like recognizing when pizza night's gonna happen.
Exactly.
And when it's not gonna happen.
Exactly. Yep. And it's gonna be perfect if you have the time to let your dough proof, properly at room temperature, to preheat your oven, to have your ingredients at room temperature. There's so many little factors that go into making the perfect pizza.
Why do you like this so much to do a book? You obviously know a lot. You obviously are interested in testing things out, but why?
Well, I do I love pizza. It is my most favorite meal. For as long as I can remember, I just feel like pizza and salad, it's a perfect meal. What is better? A good pizza, a good salad. I feel like probably during the pandemic, I was making pizza, pizza night became, more than just once a week. We were doing it regularly. And I found myself getting bored with the three topping combinations that I was making.
Right.
And I was like, if I'm getting bored, surely other people are getting bored. And maybe I could come up with enough ideas to inspire, one pizza night a week.
You must have really liked it because, you're talking about a good 7-year gap between your two books.
Yeah.
Which is, for a book that succeeded in New York Times bestseller, all that, usually want to write it quicker, but pizza must have been really grabbed you to this is the time.
Well, yeah. I swore I would never write another cookbook. And then, a few years after Bread, Toast, Crumbs came out, I was trying to write a vegetable cookbook. I love vegetables. I'm not vegetarian by any means, but I like cooking vegetarian meals. Mm-hmm. And I just couldn't come up with anything that was, I feel like, unique or different than what was already out there. And then just the more I thought about it, it is a passion. I do. I love making bread. I love making pizza. I get questions all the time on my blog. I would say probably 90% of the questions are troubleshooting questions with bread or pizza. And over the years, I feel like I've been able to learn how to troubleshoot a little bit better, by asking the right questions earlier so that it's not a back and forth, an hour spent troubleshooting. I feel like I can pinpoint where people are going wrong earlier.
You're like the doctor. You're the pizza doctor. Let's just go there. Or the pizza prof, pizza professor, one of those ones. Okay. All right. I want to get into some specific recipes because I just enjoyed paging through the book. And we see a lot of books here.
Yeah.
We make a lot of books. You're one of our authors, but we also see books from all over the world. And there's a lot of pizza books out there, and many of them are great. I was surprised by a number of these combinations. They clearly work because you've made them. And one that really jumped out right away was blistered shishito pizza with onions and Monterey Jack. I love that as a melting cheese. Rarely do we see Monterey Jack on a pizza, I feel.
Right. Yeah.
What inspired it?
Well, it started with the shishito. So I have a friend who she's a very good gardener, and she drops off bags of them, of them at my door over the summer. They keep really well in the fridge. They last for a long time. They're not
Not a lot of moisture in them, they don't really need to retain much.
And I've always loved that. I know it's kind of cliche, but the blistered shishitos with salt as an appetizer is so fun and so simple. The combination itself was sort of started was inspired by the classic quesadilla with just of any cheese you like, but onions, roasted peppers, a good melting cheese, such a good quesadilla.
Oh, I love that combo. Next one up is sauteed radicchio with fig jam and gorgonzola. Bold, but I buy it. I like bitter greens with fig jam and a stinky astringent cheese. Loving this.
Yeah, no, I mean you hit it. I mean this one is sort of one to make at in the dead of winter when you don't have much inspiration. Produce wise, radicchio also lasts forever. I feel like it will last forever in your fridge.
Yeah,
you just have to peel off the outer outer, you know, leaf, and it's like bright. It's bitter, but when you saute it, it mellows a little bit. And pairing it with something sweet, again, tempers the bitterness. And then, yeah, the stinky cheese.
Yeah, cooking vegetables for pizza is a smart way just to use something that's maybe not that, like, super fresh, but you can cook it down and it'll be good.
Yeah, and it also, a lot of times, I mean, it releases the moisture, so it will help prevent your pizza from being soggy.
Now, Detroit pizza speaks to me as a Michigan native, and I love Detroit style. We talked about Buddy's a little bit. But this one, it's for a crowd with pepperoni, pickled jalapenos, and hot honey. Nice.
I mean, this one, totally inspired by the one served at Emmy Squared. I have their pizza book. I took a virtual cooking class with Emily. It was great. I ordered a bunch of their pizzas via Goldbelly during the pandemic. So
I read that.
Yeah, totally inspired by them. But what I love about that pizza, it's like such a good model to follow, like a pickled pepper with a cured fatty meat. Like, it doesn't matter the pepper, it doesn't matter the meat. Like, they're going to go well together. And then hot honey is just great on, I mean, it's on so many pizzas, like, just to, like, round it all, just, like, to add a little
Pauly
bit.
Pauly G invented it in Brooklyn, essentially, as many say.
Right.
And speaking of Emily Highland, her interview follows yours.
Oh, no way.
Yeah.
Amazing.
And so we have you both talking about pizza.
Oh, my gosh. Amazing. I love her.
Yeah. She's fantastic.
And they all, like, I also took a class at their restaurant. I can't remember. It was a long time ago. But I think he maybe is from New Haven. One of them's from New Haven.
Yeah. But they Matt is from New Haven,
okay.
I believe.
Yeah. So I do feel like a connection with them. They don't feel a connection with me, but I feel a connection.
Well, now they know there's a connection. This is the pairing that I think is great for our listeners. And, and my conversation with Emily later is really revealing. So I'm happy that there's this connection. The last one, I love it. And I know what's inspired it. It's hot Italian sauces, which Giardiniera and mozzarella. Let's talk about this one.
Yes. So also, this was totally inspired by Steve Dolinsky, who has a podcast. But he always is talking about, like, true Chicago-style pizza. And I was shocked to learn that it's not deep dish. Like, as an outsider, I would have totally said, oh, deep dish is Chicago-style pizza. But true Chicago-style pizza is thin crust, tavern-style, thin. And this sausage and giardiniera is a classic. And I also learned about, like, the specific giardiniera that you need to, they're different. Like, they're pickled first and then marinated in olive oil. Whereas I think just, like, you can get Italian giardiniera in the grocery store and it will just be pickled. All pickled and very harsh. And you want to get the right giardiniera for this pizza.
Yeah, you got to cut it with definitely with olive oil. And Vito and Nick's on the south side is my type of style pick.
Haven't been, but a friend went recently.
Oh, Vito and Nick's a must. Are you going to be in the Midwest for your book tour?
I'm not at the moment. I want to. I'm trying to add a few spots.
Because I mean,
I'm dying to get there. I mean, I have so many spots in the Midwest that have been on my list.
Just start at Buddy's in Detroit.
Yes, I need to. Yes.
Head to Martini's in Kalamazoo.
Okay.
Vito and Nick's on the south side.
Okay.
And then hit someplace in Lakeview.
Okay.
Not going to pick my pony, but I have some.
Oh, done.
I'm just, like, trying to book
a
tour.
No, thank you.
I'll drive, Allie. You know, straight up, I'll drive. You rest. Do your book tour. I'm a chauffeur. Let's book this.
Oh, my gosh.
We'll take it on the road.
Yeah.
What is the best dessert to pair with pizza?
Oh, I mean, so I do have 5 simple desserts.
I know you do.
Yeah.
And I love them.
I mean, I feel like affogato is the best, like, pizza dessert. But I also, I mean, I like some, I mean, I like just, like, honestly, like, a good cookie, a good brownie.
Yep.
But, you know, just a good scoop of ice, you know, forget if you don't want to do the espresso over the ice cream, just a good scoop of ice cream. I think simple.
I agree. And I think a cookie is perfect.
Yeah.
Something about cookies and pizza.
Yeah.
Or cake, if you've been to Quarter Sheets in Los Angeles.
I have not been. I know that has been on my list.
I hope you can make it out to LA and visit those guys.
I'm going to LA on the tour. So
okay.
So I will be there. And I do have a list of places there on there.
I hope you can make it. Now, what about a beverage? You know, lots of ways to go. Do you have a preferred pairing?
I've been loving Nebbiola red wine with it, but I don't know a lot about wine. I'm not really the person to ask.
All good.
So, but I love Nebbiola. That it's always good. I just feel like it's always good. And yeah, it's my go-to.
You write honestly, and I love this, and I really want to tap into it. You said you're a homebody and you have zero wanderlust. And I believe, and this made me think, I'm like, that's the key to happiness, when you realize that you are either a traveler or you're not.
Yeah.
And I feel like you, by saying it out loud or writing it out loud, it's liberating. Because, like, you know, you're giving the cosign that it's okay to want to be at home and not go out in, like, these Instagram vacations and be, you know, in these great places. Like, love that. I just want to commend you for saying that. It just, like, really unlocked something for me.
I'm such a homebody. I'm so happy at home. I'm so happy when my days look all the same. I really am a creature of habit and routine. And I am, like, I feel like I thrive in a week that looks like that. I do feel like it makes me, when I travel, and I in 2017, I went to Paris for a photography thing. And 2022, I went to Italy with my husband. That's basically it in terms of where I've traveled in the last however many years. When I do travel, I feel a little bit of, like, regret that I am such a homebody and such a creature of habit. And I wish I could be a little bit more.
No. It's liberating, though.
Yeah. No, there is a lot to see. And it's one, like, I loved Italy. I would go back to Italy in a heartbeat. You know,
but I mean, you're admitting and you're saying it that you are happier at home. And on the flip side, some people really love to travel.
Yes.
Like, and the, you acknowledge that and you base your life around it. But I think some people kind of force themselves to travel because you have to.
Yeah.
And don't admit that, like, being home is cool.
Yeah. Oh, I love it. Yeah.
Yeah. So you got the pizza book in the can. Are you going to wait another 7-8 years, or do you got another book in the works?
I have no idea in mind for another one. I really don't.
That's okay.
I feel like I do need time. I think time is good to just think about what's next. I don't have ideas.
Let's give a shout to Susan, by the way. Susan Roxburgh.
Yes, she's so wonderful.
Yeah, we both share Susan as an editor, and we both have books coming out in the same season. And I know Susan was working on your book while she's working on mine, and she was so complimentary of your work. And Susan's just the best. She's such a terrific editor, so skilled, and such a sharp eye for recipe development.
She is. She really helped me. My dough chapter was massive. I mean, well, also, I had turned in way too many words to begin with.
Yeah,
but
does happen.
My dough chapter had something like 10 plus recipes, and she was like, "Allie, you're trying to make this simple and accessible for people." And even though the recipes are still simple, I think it makes it intimidating.
Yeah.
They're four basic dough recipes. They're variations, you know, sourdough and things like that. But it's simpler, and I'm so grateful.
A perfect note. So smart. Shout out to Susan for that.
Yeah.
Just making books better here at Clock and Bottle. I love it. On This Is Taste, we ask guests about the discerning taste. So to close this interview, here's a little rapid fire, fast and furious taste check. Are you ready?
Yes.
The best fruit.
I love, like, a white, like, nectarine or peach in the summer. Sweet, juicy, like, perfect.
You live a little bit more upstate than me, but we're, like, kind of near each other.
Yeah.
And I got to say, I haven't had a good peach upstate in 2 years. It's been kind of a drought.
Yeah, no. I have them when I go to my parents in Connecticut.
Yeah.
I feel like my mom always has the best white nectarines, and I can eat like 10 a day.
I know. When they hit, and it's been a little bit of a bummer. Maybe this year will be the year.
Yeah.
It's been a little bit of wetter spring. The worst vegetable.
This is hard because I love vegetables.
Yeah.
If I had to pick, I'd say beet greens. Like, I love greens of all kind. I don't love beet greens. They just don't.
Yeah.
They don't. I don't know.
Yeah.
Not good. And I always want... Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
No. Tell me.
I mean, I just, as somebody who's had a CSA for so many years, and I really try to help people, like, use, like, leaf to root, like, use every part, I just have a hard time with beet greens.
Yeah. Wow.
Compost.
I don't think I've ever cooked with beet greens. So, wow.
Yeah.
The best dessert?
Maybe a brownie, a rich fudgy brownie.
Fudgy, not cakey.
Yeah, fudgy. Fudgy.
Fudgy all the way. Favorite American fast food chain?
I mean, as a kid, it was McDonald's, hands down. I haven't eaten at McDonald's in years. I'd say it's probably Chipotle. My kids love it. It's where we end up at hockey tournaments all the time. Their vegan, like, kids' taco meal, I think it's great. All the sauces, all the salsas, and it tastes fresh. It's good.
Yeah, I'm going to the new Chipotle restaurant, Colonel. They're launching a new concept.
Oh, cool.
So I'll let you know.
Let me know. Yeah.
You're a hockey parent.
Yes.
Love it. Yeah. Your kids, like, very into it, like, travel hockey and all that?
They are. My older three are. My youngest didn't want to do it, and we didn't push it. We
were
great.
What a great sport. Yeah. Are you a fan of hockey?
Love hockey. Yes.
So what's your team?
Well, Okay, I don't really have a fan. Two of my kids are Islanders fans.
Yeah.
My son is a Tampa Bay Lightning fan. I don't know. I feel like always connection to Philly, but I can't even say I'm a fan. I have no idea how they did or how they've done.
Gritty's the best, though, we have to admit.
Yes. Yes.
Gritty's great.
So good.
A couple more. Your favorite New York City restaurant?
Again, I feel like I don't come here enough to have a favorite because every time I come, I go to someplace else. But over winter break, we took our kids actually to an Islanders Tampa Bay game.
Fun.
And then we got back and I had read about Don Antonio's. It's actually not too far from here.
Yeah.
We walked in. It was prime dinner hour. They had a table for six.
So good.
And it was so good. It was really good. It was like, and I loved the vibe. It felt very like neighborhood people. Yeah. I don't know. I loved it.
Have you done any pizza crawls in New York? Do you have any spots?
I have a huge list. I mean, I've been to Scars. I loved Scars. Sure. I've been to Ruby Rosa. I loved it. I love it all. That's the thing. I mean, also, the places I go are places that have been written up, so they're probably going to be good.
You're a fan. You're a fan of pizza.
Yeah, I'm a fan. It's always good.
Love it. Your favorite cookbook of all time?
Chapinese Vegetables. Alice Waters.
Ooh, the vegetable one is cool.
So good. It's like every year, I feel like I know it by heart. I feel like I've made every recipe, and then every summer I pull it open. You know, it's organized by vegetable. I'll pull it open to see if I can do something, and I'll find something new. It will be perfect. It's also, I love it. It's a very old book, so it's written so differently than like how our cookbooks are written now, which are, you know, very precise, and it assumes like a certain...
A little more feel, a little more assumptions.
Yeah, I know. I love it.
That style of book is I think coming back a little bit.
I would love to see that.
I feel the other Allie in Food Allie Slagle's book is kind of like
Absolutely. Because she doesn't hide. I loved what she said. She doesn't hide the prep in the ingredient list. Like that's part of the. I love that.
Yeah, it's great. It just reminded me of her. Have you guys ever met?
I've met Allie. Yes. Yeah. And I've connected with her many times over the years. I'm a big fan.
Do you guys ever get each other's mail?
No.
I feel
no, I know.
It could happen.
I know. I don't think I've ever gotten her mail. No.
I've never confused you, just for the record. I'm not trying to admit my own sins, but you're both terrific. A couple more. Your favorite city outside America to visit for food?
I can't. I haven't been many places. Yeah. I would say Rome. I would go back in a second. I know it's easy. That's an easy place to stay, but those two, the Da Remo and Ostiense, those places that served the Tondo style pizza, again, it was just from the vibe to the pizza, to the style of food. I mean, and, you know, they had pastas and other things too. It was just, it was so good. There was so much I didn't get to.
Last one, your favorite sandwich?
You know, in the summer, I always order a BLT.
Always.
My favorite sandwich would be, Gabrielle Hamilton writes about this sandwich in Blood, Bones, and Butter. It's prosciutto, arugula, olive oil, on buttered bread. And I don't think she specifies the bread, but I want to say it's ciabatta. I like it with ciabatta. But when I read it, the description for the first time, she talks about like the union of these three fats, the fat from the prosciutto, the butter, and the olive oil. And I like had to make it immediately. And she's right. It's so good. And
sounds like the perfect pairing.
Yeah.
Allie Stafford, thank you so much for joining This Is Taste.
Thank you so much for having me. This was wonderful.
Emily Hyland, welcome to This Is Taste. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Happy to be here.
I love to meet you. I mean, Emmy Squared, you're a pizza legend in New York and around the country. You live in Santa Fe now, though. What's it like living in Santa Fe? Let me hear about that life, that Santa Fe life. I love that.
I feel much calmer. It's really peaceful to live in Santa Fe. I miss living in New York, but I come back often so I can get my good coffee and Chinese food and all that good stuff.
I respect when you see your nervous system, because when my wife and I go to Palm Springs, we have a similar, just like lets you like separate from that running restaurant stress for you, right? You just were able to.
Yeah, I run a yoga studio now. So it's a very different energy than restaurant life.
So when you're running a studio, let me ask you, do you do retreats as well in the area? Do you take people out in the desert and do yoga?
I do lead retreats. I led a retreat to Puerto Rico this winter, and I'm leading one to an island off of Vancouver in the fall, and some local stuff too.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah. So do you split time, your brain goes between yoga and then into the restaurant running world?
It's yoga, poetry, restaurants.
Poetry too, exactly. Mm-hmm. Wow. Well, let's start with pizza because I want to get a sense of your style. I think we've had a lot of operators and owners on the show, and I'd love to get a sense when you and Matt, your current partner, your former husband, you know, you guys have a unique style, and I'd like to hear it in your words of your pizza.
Sure. We make New York, New Haven style pizza. And so the idea is, though we're cooking in a wood burning oven, we're not making Neapolitan pies. The pies do not have a soupy middle. There's not a huge crust to topping ratio. It's a nice even plane for all of the toppings to land. It's a very thin crust that has a little bit of char on it. That's a little bit more well done than some other places that you might see pizza. And we have really fun, inventive toppings on there.
I mean, they really are. I mean, you have a lot. It's like a really full menu. But let's go back to the idea of like not doing Neo, but with a oven that is fired by wood and it's probably north of 700 degrees, I'd imagine, maybe into the 900 degrees, but firmly not doing Neo. I love it.
Yes, that was for Matt. He always labeled us as making fiercely American pizza. And for him, as someone who came up in Connecticut and has spent many years as a chef in New York City, the merging of the New Haven and the New York styles felt really resonant to him and to me, too. I don't want a soupy bite of pizza. I want a bite that holds up texturally and has balance in its flavors.
Yeah, it really does hold up. It's really a special pie. So Matt worked at Soda Casa, which I think to me is like such an underrated pizzeria in New York.
Agreed.
I love it. And it was on Atlantic. It was close to where I used to live. And man, what was, but that is firmly Neo. That's Neapolitan, right?
It is. Yeah. And that's to say I have no judgment. I eat all types of pizza to this day. But for us stylistically, we wanted a different approach. But Matt was working as a pizza cook and trained under Luca there.
Yeah.
And we had just moved to downtown Brooklyn. He had been working all sorts of jobs in the culinary world, pastry, you know, whatever, apps, hotline, this and that. And then when he got to Soda Casa and he put his hands on the dough, that was the moment when he was like, this is really what I want to do, where I want to head with my culinary vision. And Luca mentored him and he learned all he did through Luca and through the oven there at Sweet Little Soda Casa, where we had many, many a lovely night.
Sweet Little Soda Casa. I love that restaurant. I've had many, many great nights and days there. And I think it's a special restaurant that never gets talked about.
Right.
Literally never. Speaking of getting talked about, though, your restaurant, when you decide on the name, how is it? How does it become Emily and not Matt and Emily, not E&M? You went and eventually opened Emmy, and we'll get to what that offshoot was. But how do you get to this name?
We were really struggling coming up with a name, and that was one of the things we were just circling around a lot of names that didn't feel right in our guts. And finally, I think Matt had listened to a Freakonomics podcast about naming and had learned that Emily was a really popular, one of the most popular names and all these facets of what makes names popular.
Yeah, yeah.
And he just said one day, you know what, we're going to name it after you. And that's how it went from there. So pizza loves Emily. Pizza loves me. I'm a walking brand. And I'm really proud to be the eponymous namesake founder of the restaurant.
Yeah, absolutely. It's smart. I mean, Matt's also a very common name, too.
True.
Of the era. I know a few fellow Matts in the world and 1980s children. When you open, Matt's doing the pies. We've set that. But I want to hear about you, Emily. When you open, what is your role in the restaurant? What are you doing? How are you part of the restaurant's running, branding? Because clearly you guys got brand right away. You understood how to market. Instagram early was everywhere. And not just because it's dope food. It was just like a cultural moment for New York.
Well, thanks. Yeah, it was a really complicated entry into the food world because Matt came up as a chef. He went to culinary school. He had experience in that realm. And yeah, I had waitressed and tried my hand at bartending a little bit and that sort of thing. I'd worked at a wine bar. But I was a public school teacher in the city here. And it worked out nicely that a lot of the skills in terms of systems implementation, high level operational skills to like run a reading program, the more I ran the restaurant like a ninth grade classroom, the more functional it became, you know?
Right.
So I really dealt with the operations, with management, with that sort of thing. And that allowed Matt the space to work in his creative realm. So it was a nice complimentary action of him at the open kitchen in the back, meet at the front greeting guests and merging in the middle.
Yeah, it's fun. So you were a ninth grade teacher. Wow, let's go into that. I mean, what were you what were you reading? What were the kids reading in that age? What were you teaching?
We were reading all sorts of stuff. What were we reading? You know, Romeo and Juliet and Macbeth and all that Shakespeare and Things Fall Apart. I'm trying to think. It was so long ago, Another Life. But we read Persepolis, which is a really cool graphic novel.
Yeah.
So yeah, I taught 9 through 12, and I think my sweet spot was with the 11th graders. I helped to found a small school through Bloomberg's Small Learning Community Initiative. And that was really cool to help found and bring a school to life.
Was it successful? Was Bloomberg's initiative to do smaller learning, smaller schools effective?
I think so. I think in terms of the communities that it fostered. That said, I burnt out really hard. I came up during the peak of the Common Core initiative. And that really, I was an English teacher, and that really revamped how students were or how teachers were encouraged to teach. So we went from reading and writing lots of poetry to writing essays about informationally about poetry, for instance.
Oof,
so
rough.
I burnt out pretty quickly from that, and then was in yoga school on the weekends, and that gave me the courage to resign from the Department of Education and pursue teaching yoga. So all of this time and space opened up in my life, and that's when the restaurant kind of came into vision. Matt needed that support, and we jumped in together.
You guys jumped in together. You get your space in Clinton Hill.
We did.
And and really, honestly, like, you're still operating today. I had dinner there last night, in fact. And, you know, that broccoli salad, it's not just pizza. We'll get to your burger, because I think burger is actually the most famous dish that you do, which is, I kind of avoided. I didn't have it. No offense. I just wanted to talk about pizza, but we'll get to that. But that broccoli salad was... Let's go. Let's talk about it. I loved it.
Okay. Yeah, I'm happy that you're highlighting the broccoli salad. It is one of my favorite things on the menu. And it's simple. And it's the miso dressing. It's like a miso aioli kind of dressing that just is massaged into that raw broccoli. And the broccoli is chopped up really finely, so it's not feeling really cruciferous to you.
Mm-hmm.
You've got those cherries in there, so you get that tartness. So there's lots of layers of umami in that combination. And the best part of the broccoli salad at Emily Restaurant is it cancels out all the pizza.
Exactly. That's the thing. Like, you typically, and then no one wants, like, you have a Caesar, but no one really wants like a lame pizzeria salad, because, you know, no one wants it. But when you have a cruciferous vegetable and you're like, man, I can have pizza and burgers now because I got this fiber in me. Super smart. And I like stone fruit or like dried fruit in broccoli salads. It was great dish. Really.
Thank you.
Excellent work. Great restaurant you're running. Now let me ask you about this burger then. It's like $31. A lot of people might get a little sticker shocked. On our show, we obviously are pro restaurant. Restaurants do not make a ton of money, guys. Like, they gotta charge this price. Like, this is what you gotta charge these days. But still, that is probably for some a sticker shock.
It sure is. And earlier when the burger first went on the menu, it was a little bit less expensive. I think it was $25 or $26. And that was meant to be in response to demand and really what we could handle, because we're designed to do a lot of volume of pizza and we're not designed to make burgers, or that wasn't something that was in the plan. And so when that came on the horizon, we had to calibrate. So we had originally capped it at 25 burgers a night. It's an expensive burger, so that we could handle it, that if you really want this thing, you're going to come in, you're going to get your spot, and you're going to get your burger. And then, like with everything, over a decade, you know, rents are up, insurance prices are up, delivery fees are up. Just the cost of eating at a restaurant is higher because of how expensive all of those hidden costs that folks don't see really are.
Yeah, absolutely. It's likely the margin is not what you think it is.
Right.
But let's walk through the culinary side of it. What makes it, like, it truly has made the list forever. And I'm glad you brought up the point. I wanted to hear that also, like, how do you split pizza and burger? It's very rare that they're both good at a restaurant.
How do we,
like, split it up, like, in terms of, like, the flow of the restaurant? Because you've got, like, it's, like, hard to do both.
It was incredibly challenging in the beginning because the burger takes almost 20 minutes from start to finish because there's a resting period in there as well. And then conversely, you have this pizza oven that is burning at, you know, hundreds of degrees, and those pizzas are cooking in about 90 seconds. So it really had to be food is coming as is, and you're not getting if you're on a date and she's ordering this and you're ordering that, that pizza's coming out. You're not eating together. You got to share everything.
You got to share it. Yeah. So what's the burger? What's in the, what makes it your burger?
What makes it our burger is the pretzel bun. I really think that was a huge vision point that Matt had that has really led the industry in a lot of ways. Yeah. You know, when you see places like Wendy's having a pretzel bun, I don't know. I feel like Matt Hyland saw that. But it has Pat LaFreda meat, cheddar cheese, tons of caramelized onions on there. The bun is nice and buttered. And then we have our ever famous Emmy sauce, which is a gochujang based aioli that's just like umami flavor bomb.
Yeah, it's a great setup. And it's big. It's a big burger.
It is gnarly.
It's gnarly for sure. I saw a couple next to us. They definitely split the burger and they definitely took the pizza to go, which I thought was wise. So you got like two meals out of it. You get like four slices left. Got the burger, had some sides, had some drinks.
There you go. You know, crack an egg on that leftover pizza and you got some breakfast.
Crack an egg on the pizza or eat it cold. I love it. All right, so let's transition to Emmy Squared. So you're doing Detroit style. Again, you and Matt, vision, because you're doing Detroit before Detroit is at literally fast food pizza places. I'm from Michigan, so I'm a huge fan of that style. How did you guys land on doing Detroit style? And what was Emmy Squared all about?
So it was meant to be the sister concept to Emily. Matt knew he wanted to stay with pizza, but wanted to do a different style of pizza. And our coming to understand what Detroit style pizza is was really a backdoor entry in. He always loved to, at home, make focaccia-like grandma pies in sheet pans and everything like that for us. And so it really developed like, okay, this is what we love. And we love a frico crust on like a bar pie. You know, and if we combine those things and cook this in a pan, this is actually a style that's Detroit style. So let's order a lot of buddies and have it shipped to us and start doing some R&D.
God bless buddies. Nice call there.
Yeah. So it was taste testing and then him really just like homing in on the vision for that. So you get that beautiful focaccia like middle, the crispy fried cheese edge, and then those sauce stripes on top of it that make it that signature Detroit style.
Where do you stand on ranch?
Oh, I could take a bath in ranch.
Yeah. It's the pizza I had last night was a ranch pie, a white pie, which I really with bacon, and that was tremendous. I loved seeing ranch.
Nice.
I definitely love that you brought Detroit pie to the masses. So are you involved with Emmy Squared now still?
No, we're just the founders watching our baby who's off in the world, you know, graduated from college and doing its thing. It's pretty cool to see it coming into its own from the sidelines and having the opportunity to really embark on next chapter work.
That's cool. So what does that mean when you're on the sidelines? Like, are there a lot of Emmy Squareds now? I'm not less familiar with that brand.
There are. Emmy Squared goes from New York to Florida now. And I was actually just visiting my father who lives outside of Fort Lauderdale. And the newest Emmy just opened in Fort Lauderdale. So it was a real special moment for me and him to go to the Emmy Square there and see this creation that I had nothing to, you know, I used to pick the paint colors on the walls and that sort of thing. And then to walk into this beautiful restaurant that has evolved from my vision and go and have the experience of eating there. So
that's fun.
Yeah, it was really neat.
How many locations are there about now?
I believe there's about 26, if I'm correct.
Wow. Dang, so there's 26 Emmy Squared, and you're like founding partners, but you're not involved day to day. Sounds like a pretty like cool opportunity to see your brand grow. And the pizza's good, I would imagine, still.
Oh, it is damn good. You know, it's hard when something grows like that to keep consistency and quality.
Fully.
And the operating systems they have in place there are really wonderful, and I'm really impressed with everything they're doing. And yeah, it's been a real gift. You know, I'm not someone who came up in the culinary world like being like, I want to open restaurants. It just is kind of the way my life went. And I wound up in that experience. So it was this decade of like flourishing unexpectedly while also diving into the abyss of all the perils of restaurant life. We've all seen the bear and know what it's like.
That was it.
Yeah.
It felt a little close to you. You brought up the bear, not me. I love you that you did that. Pretty hit close to home.
Yeah, almost so much that I didn't watch season two. It's like I already know. All my friends were like, you need to watch this. It's like I know I could write the show.
Yeah, exactly. A lot of chefs I've had who don't even want to talk about it, but I'm glad you brought it up. 26 locations. You have like more locations than Buddy's by a long shot.
Oh, look at that.
I mean, it's like, wow. I mean, it's cool. I like seeing Detroit Pie. I gotta check one out when I'm out in the world, a new ME squared. I want to check back and maybe I'll report back on my travels.
Do. And you got the VIP hotline for reservations right here.
Oh, so. I feel like I got you on the gram. So I appreciate you can, it's like the bat phone. I want to talk to you about you. So you and Matt divorced and you're both remarried and you're open to talking about this, which I appreciate. It seems it's like relatively rare when a couple can leave and separate at least their marriage, but then continue to work together on a restaurant. Talk about that that work that you had to do to get to this point. It's not, I recognize it being quite challenging. I think for our listeners, you know, going through separation is part of life and many have. So let me ask you what that was like and what can you say about working with your ex-husband?
I have a lot to say on that.
Sure, let's go there.
Yeah, well, first of all, I have my my debut collection of poetry coming out with a small press called Howling Bird Press this October, which is called Divorced Business Partners.
I saw that. What a great, that's great.
Thank you, that's which cool. is inspired by this whole experience. And as I was talking about with Kendra earlier, she was quoting Eric Clapton and had this great phrase where it really tries to put a stamp on the emotions of a hard time in life and really capture the essence of what it's like to be vulnerable while you're in the thick of it. So anyway, that's coming out. But it was a really, I mean, the experience of opening Emily Restaurant and then going through the divorce and then coming out on the other side with a deep sense of kinship and partnership in business with Matt has been, I think, one of the biggest learning experiences of my life. And I'm grateful for all that it's offered. Because we're both with people now who are much better suited to be with in life. And he's happy with his lovely wife opening restaurants. And I'm happy with my lovely husband climbing around in the mountains. So that's good. But in terms of the restaurant, you know, it was so busy. And we were both back to that idea of the nervous system in like complete active nervous system deregulation from like day one of the restaurant. Cause like, how do you do everything? We didn't have a porter the first 2 months. We were like coming in and cleaning the bathrooms and then like figuring out what the heck it is to like do the a million things you need to do and then go into service and then figure out how you close out a cash drawer and, you know, all that sort of stuff. And so we were in the momentum and in the busyness and like the muck of it all that I missed getting to appreciate the sweetness. Like just as that restaurant was so special and so sweet, I missed, and I can only speak from my perspective, but I missed the sweetness of it. You know, when there were these moments when the wait list was like 3 hours long and I was like trying to seat a table and I would like have a moment of pause and see Matt at the oven and like really see him in what he was meant to be doing in life, you know, and have that beauty. But there'd be a disconnection because our management styles were so different and like we couldn't function. You know, we were doing our best to stay afloat. And so things got really, really ugly. We had a very harrowing divorce, which is, you know, really painful for anyone who's gone through that kind of experience. And I wound up taking a leave of absence from both ME Squared and Emily Restaurant Original. And we just had a lot of space. And then, you know, time, and you don't think it'll happen, but like time and distance really do help heal. And as the emotional stuff started to fade away and as we moved on with life, it became clear that we still love each other and are still family. And, you know, we met in college when we were still teenagers and we came up together. And so there's something that's really beautiful in that. And to me, Emily Restaurant is like our baby, our child.
Yeah.
And so that really yokes us and links us and is this very special place that we both are invested in emotionally and care for and have deep respect for each other and supporting each other and where we are in life right now.
I love that. Thank you for sharing. It's really, I think, powerful when you talk about the ups and downs of a divorce. And also just to observe, you know, your name is on the door. So like when you divorce, that makes it very public because it's like you're not there anymore. So I must have added a layer of just dramatic drama to the whole thing.
There was drama.
Yeah.
I think, you know, the idea, it was called, you know, Pizza Loves Emily.
Yeah.
And so that, you know, he named it in this big romantic gesture for me. And from my perspective, I had a very hard time separating the personal and the business during that time in our lives. And, you know, that was when I really came to understand business is not personal.
Yeah.
And it was so personal for us. It's like, how do you open a restaurant with your husband with, you know, my mom was helping to clean sinks and his mom was coming and bringing supplies and my dad was running to Home Depot to get hooks for the wall. And like, it was really, my sister was one of our opening staff members. It was like a part of our family. And so that was a hard won lesson that business is not personal. And it also is really nice from a point of nostalgia to, like, for me, the Emily the Cookbook is really like this time in our lives that's like encased in history. You know,
yeah.
It starts with the picture in the beginning of the book is kind of the iconic picture of us holding hands right when we open outside the restaurant. And then what the final picture in the book is a picture of us outside of the West Village right after that opened, just I think a few weeks before we separated, which was a very unexpected thing. I don't think we realized we would.
When you took that photo, you didn't realize that this would be like 2 weeks before.
Wow. Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, but then again, like, you've opened this restaurant that has met way more success than you could have ever imagined. You open another concept that meets all of this success and support. Everybody is really supportive. Investors start coming around wanting to grow things and then you're snowballing and everything. And, you know, how do you not get lost in the middle of that? And, you know, we were pretty young when this was happening. This was all in our early 30s.
Yeah.
It's, you know, the life experience is we're real teachers and I built so much resilience from it. And I think to say that these things just like happen and restaurants open and everyone is happy, that's not the truth of it. And you know, it wouldn't be as what it is if we hadn't gone through all of that.
No, and you exited the Emmy Squared business too, and that's something that never really happens. Restaurant groups get offered these deals all the time, and you're one of the rare ones who can, you know, happily walk away and be on the sidelines. So you must feel a level of, you and Matt feel a level of pride about that.
Oh, I cannot believe what this all turned into. I mean, I really thought we were going to be living in his mom's basement, like 6 months after opening, you know, like I did not think it was going to be successful. We were impulsive in opening and thinking about location. There wasn't much thinking. It was like, oh, we've been to Clinton Hill once. We're seeing this spot. It shuttered. We didn't realize that's where Emily's going. And
yeah.
Like, just, it was a lot of like very gut based. Again, there felt like there was this propulsion driving us into what this all became. And now to be on the other side of it and see what Emmy Squared has become, I couldn't be more proud
yeah.
and grateful for all of it.
It's pretty great. What was your first rent in Clinton Hill?
The first, like, how much it
yeah,
cost,
yeah, how much
you
it
mean?
Cost that first.
Oh, God, it was so cheap back then.
Right, that's what I'm saying. Because it was like
2014.
14, yeah.
That might have been like $4,000
yeah, you whisper
month.
Into the mic. I mean,
$4,000 a month.
You look at like downtown Brooklyn, Clinton Hill, right by Atlantic. I mean, what, you know that. I mean, you know what your rent is now. So
yeah, it's not
a little
that.
Bit more.
It's a lot a bit more.
But see, like, that is, I just want to like build this like kind of image for anyone listening to the show who kind of wonders about $31 burgers and pizzas in the 20s. Like, it's, if you triple your rent, like, come on, like, labor is up. Like, it's, you got to charge what you charge.
Yeah. Another thing I'd like to say about that too is we have quite a few employees that have been with us for almost the whole 10-year stint that we've been around. And Matt and I are both very aligned in terms of, especially because this is like our one-off and we can do what we want there, essentially, we really value paying people well. And so that's another factor that goes into prices. Mm-hmm. You know, like, our manager started as a hostess and trained under me as a hostess, and now she runs the show. Our head chef, Sammy, he started off as a daytime prep guy, and now he's the head chef who studied under Matt all those years.
And maybe running a TikTok account soon.
There you go.
Sammy,
yeah.
watch this space.
Please watch Sammy on TikTok. But anyway, you know, it's valuable to us as humans that we pay those folks really well. They've been with us a decade, and that kind of yeah. adds up, you know? So
of course it adds up, and yeah. you have to sell a lot of pizzas. But then you've got these like predatory, you know, delivery services that you kind of have to use. Yeah, it's challenging. I recognize the challenge.
Oh yeah, the delivery. I mean, it's ridiculous. I'm staying in town right now, and I ordered some food the other day, and it's like, what?
Yeah.
How is this like $70 right now, and it's all the fees?
So yeah, what do you think about returning to Brooklyn when you're when you don't live here anymore? I mean, what's I've done the same. I lived in Brooklyn for almost 20 years, and now I don't live in Brooklyn. So I got thoughts, but what about yours?
I love coming back. It's really nice to visit, and I get my mocha from Hungry Ghost, and I get my nice dry pepper style from Han Dynasty, and all my kind of staples that I love. And you know, I lived in downtown Brooklyn. I spent so much time in Clinton Hill. I lived in Prospect Heights and had helped open a yoga studio there. So there's a lot of sweetness in that whole area that I just love to walk around and take in.
Yeah, those are mostly my same thoughts. And when I said that I have thoughts, it's not like I have notes. It's just, I mean, I know like Gowanus is like absolutely different. I mean, holy shit. Like the amount of building once the rezoning happened and the Superfund site, it's like crazy to see. I'm sure there's going to be an Emmy Squared somewhere near there. I know there already is one there, but there'll be more.
Let's hope so.
I know, right on.
Matt and I, we had moved into one of the first tall buildings in downtown Brooklyn right over on Hoyt and Skirmerhorn. What was that, like 12, 13 years ago? I don't know, however long that before Emily opened. And it's wild to come back. And every time I come, it's like there's five new towers twice as tall as that one.
So. I know. It's an interesting dynamic, downtown Brooklyn. Really fascinating place to live. Now, your full-time job is yoga and poetry, and you obviously run Emily too, but from a distance. Do you feel like you'll have a restaurant in Santa Fe in your future? You said that so fast. I love that. You cut me off.
Yeah. I have no interest in ever opening a restaurant ever again. The labor of love that is, I commend people who, you know, I actually had dinner with Matt and his wife, Simone, a few months ago when they were both in for the 10-year anniversary of the restaurant. And I was talking to the two of them because they just opened their first restaurant together called Zoe Tong down in Austin, which looks fantastic. And they have plans for more. And I was thinking, how do you have the energy to sustain this? And, you know, she was saying this is just what I do. And that's like chef life. You know, the two of them are chefs, and I'm not, you know, I'm not a chef. I just happen to be along for the ride for a little bit.
Yeah. You're such a unique place in food. You know, your namesake, you ran a restaurant, you're an expert in pizza, but you're not like in the restaurant world anymore.
Yeah.
It's cool.
And also, you know, I always feel like I was labeled as like a female restaurant entrepreneur, and I don't feel like I'm an entrepreneur. You know, I just, again, happened along this path for a little while.
Yeah, no. On This Is Taste, we ask guests about their discerning taste. So to close this interview, here's a little rapid fire, fast and furious taste check. Are you ready?
I think so.
Great. The best fruit?
Blueberries.
Why?
Like I like those big fat, like genetically modified ones now that just taste so sweet and amazing.
Yeah, those ones, they defy science. They defy logic.
In 10 years, they're going to be like the size of a face, and I can't wait for it.
It's kind of like, you know how Reese's got bigger?
Mm-hmm.
It's like blueberries will hit the Reese's.
Bring it.
That's what's going to happen. The worst vegetable.
Bok choy.
So let me ask you, bok choy, this hurts me.
It hurts you.
I fucking love bok
it's
choy.
It's slimy.
Yeah.
I can't.
Okay. fair enough. I mean, this is no judgment zone, but I rarely do debate, but I like bok choy. Have you? Okay. I don't want to even, this is your show, your call.
I can give you a backup vegetable that I don't
know. This is your answer.
Okay.
Fucking let's go. The best dessert.
Ben and Jerry's fish food ice cream.
Okay. I think I've had 150 pints in my life.
Okay.
And that's like conservative.
Okay. Then you and I are kindred spirits.
Why? Why is it so great?
Why?
No words.
Oh, I mean, it's like orgasmic. The like marshmallow, caramel, melty chocolate, like, ooh.
I love that. I love fish food because, you know, they somehow like the actual, the chocolate, it doesn't taste weird. It's actually a really nice chocolate in there.
It is good. I do something really gross with my fish food though. I like pick out or even will like spit out the little dark chocolate things and collect them in the top of the pint and then eat those afterwards.
I love that move. I've never tried that.
Because you get this nice smooth like chocolate caramel marshmallow like smoothness and then you eat the chocolate separately.
That's like very interactive. I'm
pro
into that.
Tip.
Pro tip. Your favorite New York City restaurant right now?
Uplands.
Right?
Yep. I think they have the best cacio e pepe in the city, I will go so far as to say. And every time I come in, I have lunch there.
Yeah. Man, I haven't heard Upland in a minute. I love that.
So good.
I love that call. It's so good. Your favorite cookbook of all time?
I think The Joy of Cooking. It reminds me of my mom.
I love that answer. Any recent cookbook discoveries?
You know, I really like Jake Cohen's Jewish.
Yeah.
It's just got like good home nostalgia-y staples in there.
Yeah, he's a terrific developer, too. He's got a great sense of what a recipe has to be.
And a really nice person. And yeah. I actually think he and his partner got engaged at one of my restaurants, or there was something related to him getting married in one of my restaurants a long time ago, which I can't remember exactly, but I have a nice little connection.
Very cute. I love that.
Yeah.
Your favorite city outside America to visit for food?
According to Larry David, I would say I don't really like to leave the continent.
Fair enough. I'll take that quote. I love it. A cuisine you'd like to learn more about?
I think there's so many cuisines. I love Berber and Ethiopian food. And so I would love to learn more about that.
Yeah, I love that answer. Last one, your favorite sandwich?
Favorite sandwich, breakfast burrito.
Wow. What makes a good breakfast burrito for you?
I mean, Santa Fe is like the land of breakfast burritos, but like some hash browns in there, some, you know, chili, either coated like a smothered burrito. I don't know. Cheese, eggs, no meat for me.
Yeah, but no meat for you.
Yeah, hash browns in there are good.
I have to say, the burrito answer for a favorite sandwich is really stretching the definition of a sandwich, I must say.
Yeah? How about an egg and cheese, salt, pepper, ketchup?
Love that answer, too. Okay, salt, pepper, ketchup's really good. Abiquiu, what a cool place. You ever go out there?
Yeah, I went to Ghost Ranch many years ago for a writing and grief retreat. And when I got to New Mexico for the first time there, that was what really was like compelling me to move there and change my life.
That's
to make that home.
Special. Yeah, it's really beautiful out there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, what a cool city. Nice to meet you. Thanks for being on This Is Taste, Emily.
Thank you for having me.
This Is Taste is hosted by Eliza Abarbanel and me, Matt Rodbard. The show is produced by Shalia Harris and Pat Stango and edited by Clayton Gumbert. Theme music by Steve Rydell. Visit Taste online at tastecooking.com and make sure to subscribe to our newsletter for updates on all cool things that are happening.